What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And John, to me, and I think to you, there's really nothing like the smell of newsprint or the marks it leaves on your walls. I know my wife reminds me of that. And when I was doing a daily talk show, as you know, I was voluminous. I would bring in newspaper upon newspaper.
I know you would cover up the board with it.
Oh, I know. I was terrible. But you never knew what material you were going to need. And there's nothing like the resource of a newspaper. There's so much valuable information in it. But the sad reality is, John, the newspapers that we remember are struggling and many are dying.
No, and they're not covering the stories like they used to. I mean, they used to cover everything and they could cover a story and really get to the bottom of stuff. And now most newspapers have very little staff left.
Well, I mean, think about it, John. Some of the expenses that they can cut, many of them can't cut the cost of paper or the printing. Now, many of them have outsourced their printing, but it's still got to be done.
Right.
Then they've got to do all the distribution. They have to do the marketing and the advertising. So where do they cut at times? From the reporting staff.
Exactly.
Because they can get material from other sources,
right,
that's
AP
cheaper.
And stuff. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's a really difficult situation for them. But what we're finding across America, John, is what is developing called a news desert. And that means that within 100 miles of, let's say, Topeka or Youngstown or some of these types of communities that are large in their own right, but they're not huge urban centers. They either now are down to one paper or no paper, or maybe a paper that's publishing on paper 4 days a week,
yeah,
and online
weekly,
for three,
yeah,
or going to weekly, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And within 10 years, John, if this trend continues, it's going to be very difficult for me to mess up the walls with newsprint, because I think the New York Times said that they don't think there'll be a print edition of the Times in a decade.
And what's sad, I think, and what I've seen with a lot of papers, they haven't even figured out the internet really good. I mean, their sites are usually horrible to navigate around to find stuff. So, I mean, they're not making it there. They're not making it with
Well, they're trying. Yeah, they're trying to decide, well, do we put up a paywall? And
right,
it's okay to put up a paywall,
part.
But if there's nothing behind the paywall, why would I pay for it? Or you go around their paywall and you find these aggregator sites that take a couple of their major stories and you say, okay, that's enough for me.
Right.
I know that goes on today in some newspapers in the state of Connecticut where we are. But no newspaper means something really important, John, in a community. And in fact, our guest, Dan Kennedy, who teaches journalism at Northeastern and has written a number of books on this topic. And the one that we talk most about is The Wired City, Reimagining Journalism in the Post-Newspaper Age. But one of the things that surprised me is that there is some kind of correlation between having no newspaper and having higher taxes. Because if you're not following what's going on at City Hall, if you've got a free pass and nobody's covering the Board of Aldermen,
right,
or elders or town council.
Well, I would think corruption would be
rampant.
Rampant.
Well, who knows? Who knows?
Who knows where that high tax money's going, right?
Well, the point is that the FBI doesn't often come into a community unless some others are starting to sniff around and expose some things.
Right.
And then all of a sudden the whole can of worms opens up. But the can of worms can't open up if, in fact, there are fewer.
Investigating.
Exactly. Right. And let's be honest about it, John, because you and I have worked more in the electronic media. Most local radio stations do no serious news gathering.
Nothing.
They are reliant on the newspaper.
Yep.
Or what goes on online. And our kids now are not helping the future newspapers, because all of their news they're getting
off their phone,
on their phone through their news feed, already filtered to make certain they never hear anything that they don't want to hear,
exactly.
And that their biases are reinforced. It's
their
not
algorithms
a really
are working.
Yeah, it's not a really pretty picture, John. And I'll tell you, years ago when I was taking when I was getting my master's degree, a course on public relations, and I remember at that time the number that I recall was that 60%. Of all the stories in a newspaper originate from a news release. So somebody wants you to cover something. Now they take that news release and they say, hey, John, over in the city desk, go check this out and add a little bit, get a couple of quotes. And basically it's already fed news.
Right.
Now that number of 60%, I really wonder what that is today.
Wow, that's spooky.
And the other thing, John, of course, if you do have a newspaper today in your local community and you're very lucky, the question really is it locally owned? And is there a profit motivation behind it that drives the kind of staffing on the editorial side? So there are so many of these issues at play today.
Yeah, it's scary. It's scary. So, you know, and where can you trust your news you're getting it from then? You know, because you look at television and you look at the commercials and they're paying the bills for the station. So, you know, they're not going to say anything bad about any of that stuff, right?
Oh, the commercial element to a lot of things really does prejudice what you're seeing. Well, it can break your heart. I mean, this entire story about the lack of locally owned newspapers, the impact of consolidations on local coverage, the old typesetters put out of business, and how enterprise journalism, I mean, forget that. How many newspapers have an investigative arm left?
Yeah.
They've been cut off too. Well, let's talk to Dan Kennedy and we'll get the full picture. We do need to understand this. And then you need to think about the impact it's having in your community.
Save your paper.
Save your paper. That's right. Welcome to Dan Kennedy here on America Trends.
With me on the line on America Trends is Dan Kennedy, journalism professor at Northeastern University. And he wrote the book, The Wired City, Reimagining Journalism and Civic Life in the Post-Newspaper Age. So, Dan, you kind of called the question early on in the title of your book. Are we in a post-newspaper age?
Well, I mean, I think that when I wrote The Wired City, the title was referring to the idea that we are moving beyond print. And that is a process that is obviously continuing. At the same time, I think that what we're hoping for is the survival and sustainability of projects that may be digital only, but that have many of the characteristics of newspapers, because I think that that type of journalism is essential to democracy.
Absolutely. And let's go back just a little bit, because for a lot of people who don't pay that much attention and yet are listening to this podcast, they might have thought that in the old days it was said that TV and radio stations used to have licenses to print money, and they might have had the same observation about the newspaper. Was that the case at some point in our history? And if so, what happened?
It really was the case that newspapers went through a period of about 30 or 40 years in which they were fantastically profitable. And I should say that this was, historically speaking, a fairly recent phenomenon. In fact, newspaper readership per household has been on the decline since the 1920s. People used to get multiple newspapers delivered to their home. And then over time, you know, eight-paper cities became four-paper cities, became two. And eventually, almost every city in the country became a one-newspaper town. You can kind of trace the development of this to about the mid-60s. Rise of one-newspaper towns actually resulted in fantastic profits for the surviving newspapers. They had no competition. They were competing with TV and radio, obviously, but there were certain types of advertising that was best suited for newspapers, especially classified ads and those pages and pages of department store ads that we used to see on a Sunday. So from the mid-60s up until maybe 15 years ago, newspapers were really in their golden age, and not just journalistically, but they were raking in the gold. We're probably never going to see anything like that again, and we never saw anything like that before that period. But we certainly want to find ways to at least pay for the journalism that we need to govern ourselves.
When we do look at it, the numbers, as I have been getting ready for this interview, are pretty startling about the declines. And, of course, many of us would attribute it to the digital age, the smartphone. Young people, how many of them really subscribe to a local newspaper? I mean, if you looked at it in aggregate and you tried to dissect what the factors have been, would it be technology really changing the way we consume news?
I think that technology explains most of the decline in news. And it isn't so much a decline in readership. People are still consuming plenty of newspaper content. But the internet destroyed the news advertising business. You know, classified ads at one time comprised about 40% of newspaper revenues. And that's all gone to Craigslist. I mean, virtually all of it. And Craigslist, as you know, is mostly free. And you can't compete with free. Facebook and Google have taken most of the rest of the advertising. And in fact, in recent years, more than 90% of all new spending on digital advertising has gone to Facebook and Google. And the result of all this is that newspapers that are trying to be forward-looking today, which actually is the subject of my more recent book, The Return of the Moguls, working very hard to try to figure out ways to get their readers to pay for digital news consumption. This has been more successful at the national level than it has at the regional or the local level, but that's really where the emphasis is these days, because I think everybody understands that the ad revenues are not coming back.
Absolutely. And even if a newspaper does exist, at best, as you say, it's printing perhaps one daily edition where once there were two papers, and now it's the sole source in the community, as many radio stations other than public radio have gotten out of the news gathering business. And it's one of those things that, in a sense, they are, in a way, ghost newspapers, because there is really nothing that they're competing against. And the only ways that they cut money from their budget are with variable costs. And often those variable costs are, well, local reporters.
That's exactly right. And that would lead me into, I mean, as I said, I think that the internet is responsible for most of the decline of newspapers. But there's another factor, too, that we really shouldn't overlook, and that is the role of corporate chains in squeezing newspapers dry. I think that when you look at chains such as Media News Group, the former Digital First, which used to own the New Haven Register, I should point out, Gatehouse Media, Gannett, some of the others, I think that you're seeing cutbacks that exceed what would be needed just to break even and make a little bit of a profit, because they have to satisfy their shareholders. In some cases, they have to satisfy the hedge fund managers that own them. And they have to service the debt that they took on to assemble these gigantic chains. So the newspaper business would be under severe challenge no matter what. But I think that corporate ownership has made it somewhat worse than it would otherwise be.
And when we look at rural communities, there's been much written about this phenomenon of a news desert. How prevalent is that, where really people don't have any local newspaper to speak of?
It's pretty prevalent in large parts of the country. I think we're a little bit luckier in New England than we are in other parts of the country. I know that the University of North Carolina, which has done a study of this, actually said that there are no news deserts in Massachusetts, and I don't think there are in Connecticut either. So what we end up with here is we don't necessarily have unserved communities, but we do have underserved communities. Elsewhere in the country, it's much worse. There were whole counties that have just been completely abandoned, and it's not clear what can be done to restore some sort of coverage to those communities.
When we talk about local news and the lack of it, it has so many impacts, Dan, and I'm not certain that everybody really has thought about what those might be. But when you think about civic engagement, understanding what's going on in your community, holding various officials to account, all of that has to suffer dramatically when there is no one really keeping an eye on what's going on at City Hall, town meetings, and the like.
No, that's absolutely right. There have been some academic studies that have shown that when local news coverage is non-existent or minimal, voter participation declines. People aren't finding out about who's running for office, and they don't vote. There was even a fascinating study done a year or two ago that showed that in communities that no longer have any local coverage, the cost of municipal borrowing goes up. And the conjecture behind this was that people who want to lend money to municipalities are going to demand a higher interest rate to guard against the risk that their money will be lost to corruption because nobody's keeping an eye on it. So this is really serious, serious business.
Absolutely. Now, I know there have been many attempts to figure out what a good model is in terms of a newspaper that wants to get into the digital age. So some were printing, I recall, I think it was Detroit years ago. Well, they decided, let's print 3 days a week, go online, the rest, make certain we have a Sunday newspaper for all the various advertising. Then there have been weeklies that have been come up to fill the breach, or this patch model where a one-person gang in a community starts taking over and trying to inform the public. I mean, have any of those models been satisfactory?
I would say that when you look at the Detroit Free Press going to 3 days a week, the New Orleans Times-Picayune, same owner, I should say, tried the same thing. And eventually, the Times-Picayune collapsed, and a locally owned independent competitor has moved in to pick up the coverage in New Orleans. There are a number of interesting experiments that have been tried. One of the experiments that I think is particularly worth watching is taking place at the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, where, believe it or not, they are cutting back to Sunday-only print, but they're giving iPads to their subscribers so that they can read the paper online the rest of the week. And they believe that by giving away iPads, they're going to maintain at least 75% of their subscribers, which is what they believe that they need to return to profitability. Apparently, I'm not exactly sure how this would work, but apparently if you let your subscription lapse, the iPad stops working. And, you know, much closer to home, you began by mentioning my book, The Wired City. The Wired City is mostly about the New Haven Independent, which is nonprofit, digital only, funded by, you know, community foundations and reader donations and things like that. And even though they only have a handful of staff people, they really have kind of emerged as the news source of record in New Haven over the 14 years that they've been in existence. Not to show any disrespect to the New Haven Register, I know that Matt Dorenzo is back as the editor, which I think is a great thing, and I think that the Hearst chain that owns the Register is at least a little bit better than some of the other chains.
Yeah, that's interesting, and we will talk about that. Well, we can do it right now. I mean, the New Haven Register, for example, I read for a volunteer service called Chris Radio in New Haven, and we read the New Haven Register as the paper of record, if you will, in New Haven. And they are doing a lot more local coverage. Now, mind you, they have bought just about everything in that southwestern tier, and so they are merging a lot of editorial activity with perhaps fewer reporters, but they are covering a wider territory. And so they are trying to some way reclaim a part of the heritage that the New Haven Register has had. And I've got to believe, to some extent, they're very mindful of the impact that this New Haven Independent is having. But how much of an anomaly is what we're seeing, where Hearst is really still trying and perhaps putting new emphasis on reporting, enterprise or investigative reporting under Matt DiRenzo. And then, of course, you've got this New Haven Independent. Is that more vibrancy in a community the size of the New Haven area than in most parts of the country?
Well, I'd like to say that New Haven, even looking at just the Independent, is probably the best covered medium-sized city in America. And it's simply a matter of luck. I mean, the founder of the New Haven Independent, Paul Bass, is probably the best journalist that New Haven ever produced. And he remains dedicated to hardcore community journalism after years and years at the New Haven Advocate and in other capacities. And he's really done a remarkable job. When I was doing my reporting for the Wired City, you had, depending on how you count it, they had four or five people covering the city, which was actually comparable to what the New Haven Register was doing. The Register had a much larger staff, but only about four or five people were devoted to covering the city of New Haven. Today, the Independent has supplemented what it does with a low-power community FM radio station that has brought in all kinds of voices from the community. And if you put together the community coverage that the Independent offers with the ongoing conversation that you see on the radio station, it's really quite a remarkable thing. And then to add to that the fact that the New Haven Register has not thrown in the towel, but is actually still trying to do a good job of covering the community, I think that people who live in New Haven and the surrounding area are being amazingly well served given what's going on in 2019.
Absolutely. How difficult, though? I mean, there aren't Paul Basses everywhere who have the energy, the determination. He was working for about $77,000 a year. I mean, so you look at it and you say, are these models sustainable? What happens to the Independent if anything happens to that one person? And you begin to wonder again about sustainability when it comes to reliance on grants and nonprofit organizations to maintain that level of journalistic quality.
Right. Well, I think that, and it's funny, I think Paul said this to me years ago, and I think it's true. Depending on grant and foundation money is probably more sustainable than depending on advertising money. In this environment, when you ask about sustainability, he's been around for 14 years, and there's no reason to think that he won't be around for 15 or 20 years. And in infinite years, that's like 200 years, right? You know, I think we're in an era where projects are going to come and go. And if the Independent eventually comes to an end, that will be an unfortunate thing. But what you hope is that somebody else comes along and will try something else. I don't think that we're going to see any ultra-long-term legacy media coming out of this age. I think that what we're going to see, a lot of experiments, some of which will succeed, and frankly, a lot of which will probably fail.
What about the daily newspapers and their intent as it relates to digital? How successful have they been? You said, of course, that some of the larger papers And I would suggest they are, and they're easy to determine. The New York Times, the Washington Post have figured out some very interesting models to get into the digital era. Many others are still struggling with this, trying to figure out whether they put their content behind a paywall, make it part of the subscription, make it separate from. Have you seen an area there or an activity in that regard that you think points us toward the future?
A little bit, I do. I'm somewhat optimistic. As I said, my current book, The Return of the Moguls, is largely about how wealthy owners at the Washington Post, Jeff Bezos, and the Boston Globe, John Henry, have tried to remake the business of their newspapers. Now, I think that the big three national papers, you mentioned the Times and the Post, I would add the Wall Street Journal, they have been able to take advantage of, unfortunately, the intense interest in national news, which doesn't really extend so much to regional and local news. So all three of those newspapers have been able to amass, you know, well over a million digital subscribers, and that has left them in pretty good shape. I think that one that is more, the Boston Globe actually is more relevant to what other newspapers are trying to do, because it's smaller. It's big, but it's a regional paper. And I think that saving regional papers is one of the biggest problems that that the business has. And I do think that in some ways, John Henry has laid out a possible roadmap for other newspapers. Essentially, they went all out with digital subscriptions, and they have managed to sign up about 115,000 digital-only subscribers. As of the end of last year, they made an announcement that they were now profitable. I think that they're marginally profitable. As they continue to add digital subscriptions and lose print subscriptions, their revenues decline because print subscriptions do bring in more money. But they do believe that if they can get to 200,000 digital-only subscribers, which is their next goal, they will be financially sustainable. And they've done it with a newsroom that remains of a decent size, especially compared to other newspapers in their weight class. They still have a newsroom of about 220 full-time people. And I've noticed lately they've done some hiring, which is great. In large measure, this is to replace people who've left. But you don't see that in a lot of papers these days. Those positions just go unfilled. As an example, on the other side, we mentioned Media News Group, the former Digital First. They own the Denver Post, which is a similar size paper, similar size market to Boston and the Globe. And their newsroom is down to about 60 people. If the Globe model ends up working, I do think that it shows a way forward where if you are able to maintain the quality of your paper, you can convince people to pay for it and eventually move to sustainability. But it's a tough slog, that's for sure.
Absolutely. What about the nature of the content that moves over to digital? I did a panel recently, and I had a reporter from the Hartford Courant on, and she was talking about how specific the information that gets back to them is about the usage of various of their content when it is digitally provided. They know exactly the click-throughs, and they know the time spent, so on and so forth. How much does that change the type of reporting that editors are looking to do based upon what they anticipate is going to be the measurability of that content?
Well, I suppose that at bad newspapers, it has a lot to do with what gets covered. At good newspapers, it's a useful tool. It certainly shouldn't shape your reporting on things that people need to know. I can tell you that what I learned in my reporting at the Washington Post is that they use this data not to shape what they cover, but the way they present it. So, for instance, if you go to Washington Post content on Facebook, or if you look at the homepage, God forbid, everybody knows the homepage is dead. It's not really as dead as people think it is, but you might see a different treatment than somebody else, and they have software that will determine which treatment in terms of headline, photo, caption attracts the most eyeballs, and eventually everybody will see the one that gets the most engagement. It's the same story, and it's the same underlying headline, but the way they promote it will change based on the analytics that they're doing. So to me, that's kind of a responsible use of the metrics that are available to us these days. Using it to radically reshape your coverage is an irresponsible use because, you know, as we all know, newspapers need to cover what people want to read, but also what they should read, and you shouldn't really mess around with that.
The role of a reporter today, Dan Kennedy, how much has that changed? I know some of them are going out and collecting video. They're thinking about how this is going to be a digital piece, how it's going to sit in print. I mean, are we asking a lot of reporters today that we didn't in the past, and are they up for the task as you see it?
Asking an awful lot of reporters, that's for sure. And some of them are up for the task. Some of them have kind of overwhelmed with all of these demands. There is a description in The Wired City of Thomas McMillan, who's a former reporter for the New Haven Independent. And I accompanied him one night to a Board of Aldermen budget hearing. They still, it's still the Board of Aldermen in New Haven, I know everybody.
Board of Alders.
Mm-hmm. Board of Alders, okay. Okay, there you go. So he kind of set up shop in the spectator section of the council chambers, I'm sorry, the aldermanic chambers, one of my favorite mm-hmm. words. I don't get to use it that often.
feel free.
You know, he opened his laptop. He had his phone. He had a good quality camera. Of course, he had the budget in print, and he had a notebook. And he used his laptop to live blog the hearing. So every few minutes he would post an update to what was going on, and people would be able to see it instantly. There were people who were following his coverage who were posting comments. Now, one of the things the Independent does that I think everybody should do is that comments don't get posted until somebody has taken a look at them. So
yes,
Thomas
yes.
was reading and approving comments even as he's live blogging. He took some pictures with his good quality phone, and he shot some video, his good quality camera, and then he shot some video with his smartphone, and that got posted as well. I mean, this was really quite a feat. And then at the end of it, the live blog that he had compiled became his notes. So he wrote a story about everything that had happened that night, put it on top of the live blog, and that was his coverage. But that's what we're asking of reporters these days. And Thomas was pretty brilliant at it, but not everybody is cut out to do all those different things at once.
You talk about multitasking. That's pretty remarkable.
He wasn't even tweeting. I mean, tweeting wasn't really a thing back when I was reporting this. So today you would be adding that as well.
Exactly, because your book goes back to 2013. I was reading where a Pulitzer board member, Joyce Delly, said, journalism from smaller newspapers informed that of larger ones. And now that the coastal chains seem to manage a lot of the heartland coverage, I'm wondering, for example, if you think that we might have missed the Trump phenomenon because there aren't as many grassroots journalists out there telling us what was emerging
and some of the concerns that were coming out of their communities. Is that one of the things that we've lost in this process?
I'm not sure that I would tie the Trump phenomenon to what you're describing. That is a very fraught subject, and I have my own views. I think maybe disingenuous coverage of James Comey and Russian interference probably had more to do with it. However, let me point to another example that I think points out the value of local coverage and what happens when that doesn't get amplified by national coverage. A friend of mine, Derek Jackson, former Boston Globe reporter and columnist, was a fellow at the Joan Shorenstein Center at Harvard a few years ago, as I was about a year after Derek was. And he did a study of newspaper, well, media coverage of the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. And what he discovered was that the local coverage was quite good. There were some local media on the ground that were doing story after story about this and really doing a terrific job of informing the community of what was going on. The paper that Derek wrote about this showed that national media, including the New York Times, was very slow to pick up on this. And as a result, even though local journalism was doing a great job of telling this story, not nearly as much action was being taken as it should have because larger outlets were late in picking it up. That is really unfortunate, and I have to say I found it somewhat dispiriting because I've always believed that if people at the local level are doing their jobs, then all is right in the world. And Derek showed that, well, no, in fact, if you don't get national attention for some of these huge problems, then nothing changes.
Well, let's go back to Boston, where you operate out of, and the Spotlight Unit at the Boston Globe, Enterprise Journalism Investigations. Look at the work that was done as it relates to the Archdiocese of Boston and the impact that had on really rooting out much that was going on as it relates to sexual abuse within the church.
Absolutely. That was, what, more than 15 years ago. People will often ask, would the Globe be capable of doing that today? And it's a good question. The Globe, even though it has maintained its staffing as well as any paper you can point to probably, nevertheless is a lot smaller than it was at that time. It might be harder. I think they would do it. I think they could do it. What I do wonder is, would there be a higher level of scrutiny before they would be turned loose for, you know, many months to do nothing else other than that? The Globe still has fine investigative reporting. It still has a spotlight team. But the emphasis these days is on do the work, do something substantive and important, but let's have maybe a quicker turnaround than we did 15 or 20 years ago. And that's difficult for a story like the Catholic priest story.
Absolutely. Dan, I have a few more questions because obviously you're so knowledgeable about what's going on with journalism in America today, and we're so glad to have you on America Trends. What is the impact of this whole debate over fake news on local news?
Oh, boy, that is such a great question. I think that local news could actually be something of a solution to this horrendous debate we're having over fake news, which is really just a manifestation of the partisan divide we see between the people who support President Trump, who tend to get all of their information from him and from Fox News, and those who support and pay attention to real journalism who tend to be critics of President Trump. I think one of the big problems is that we tend not to know each other. And in local communities, we know each other. So if there are contentious issues at the local level, you hope that these get covered in the press in areas that still have that capability. But we're also talking with our neighbors and maybe going to meetings to discuss some of these issues. And as a result, I think that local news is a way that we can kind of reteach ourselves to get along with people and work together. And if we could apply some of those lessons to the national level, we might not see the divisiveness that we see today.
If there is no print component in someone's community, somebody listening to this podcast, and of course podcasts are one of the new forerunners of technology, and there's no digital alternative, as we discussed with the New Haven Independent, where do people turn? I was reading where a lot of people are turning to local news on television, but of course, if there's a television station in Topeka or Kansas City or whatever, and you live in a small town in that area, they're not going to cover what's going on in your community. Are TV stations rallying in any way? I know they're adding a lot more hours to their coverage, but is it getting more local? Is it getting more about the governance as opposed to some of the lead and bleed? What's going on with local television news in response to some of the changes on the print side?
You know, it's interesting. A couple of my colleagues at Northeastern, John Withy and Mike Baudet, have been working on a long-term project to try to come up with recommendations to improve local TV news. The problem with TV news is that the word local is a misnomer. It's regional news, and you would say the same thing about a large metropolitan daily newspaper. It's really not local at all, so they're certainly not going to be able to tell you what's going on with your local zoning board or why the pothole at the end of your street hasn't been fixed in the last 6 months. I do think TV news could be a lot better, and it would be great if it happened, but it's still going to be regional news, and it doesn't fill this gaping need for news almost at the neighborhood level, which we used to see in almost every community and now is on the wane.
What about weekly newspapers? We haven't referenced them. They show up in many small communities. They don't really go out looking for stories, perhaps, but they do report on things that are going on or in advance so you can attend a meeting on your own. How important are they in this mix?
Well, they are. I can tell you that in eastern Massachusetts, they are incredibly important. They are the key method that most of the smaller communities in eastern Massachusetts get their community news. Almost all of them are owned by Gatehouse Media, one of the big corporate chains that we're talking about. So if you look at my community, at one time, years ago, we had a daily newspaper that came out 5 days a week and had two or three people assigned to covering our community. Now we have a weekly Gatehouse paper that has one person who's doing a very good job, I should say. But, you know, it's hard to get to all the news when you're all alone. He certainly gets to the city council and covers major news coming out of the mayor's office. But if there were two of him, we would certainly have a much different type of report.
Yeah, how important is local ownership to really what we see happening on the pages of our local newspaper?
You know, I am a huge advocate and fan of local ownership. I think it is incredibly important. If you have good, committed local owners who are interested in really serving their community, who don't mind making a minimal profit. Of course, that's difficult these days, I realize. They're going to do a much better job than some out-of-town corporate owner. It's as simple as that. Now, the problem is, as we all know, there have always been really bad local owners out there who use their newspapers to serve their own personal agendas and that aren't particularly interested about doing a good job. But I think on the whole, I would rather take my chances with local owners than I would with corporate chain ownership. And of course, if you do have a bad local owner, you can kind of minimize the damage because it's just, you know, one paper or maybe one small group of papers. It isn't an entire chain with dozens and dozens of papers around the country.
In closing, I know that in the state of Connecticut, where I come from, we were one of the beacons as it relates to sunshine laws, freedom of information. And it seems as if it's really under attack. Journalists are not getting the information they need when they go to city halls and town halls, or they have to really fight their way through this. And some have the resources to do that. Others may give up along the way. As we look at this difficulty that we're having sustaining local newspapers in combination with the assaults on freedom of information, at least in my state, is that something that we're seeing replicated across the country?
Well, I'm not really sure whether it is getting worse than it used to be. I can speak to somebody who has worked as a journalist in Massachusetts my entire career, and public information in Massachusetts has always been abysmal. There was a reform passed a few years ago that made it slightly better, but it's still not very good. The governor's office is exempt. The legislature is exempt.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The judiciary is exempt. It really only applies to cities, towns, and executive agencies. And there's virtually no punishment if you violate the law. I do a yearly feature called the New England Muzzle Awards, where we look at outrages against the First Amendment that took place in New England over the previous years. We published that at WGBHnews.org. And one of the Muzzle Awards we gave was to the Massachusetts State Police for several actions that they undertook the previous year. One of them was they had investigative records pertaining to a quadruple homicide in the western part of the state. The Mass Live website, part of the Springfield Republican, had tried to get those records. The Secretary of State's office ruled that they were public records, and the state police still refused to hand them over. And there's really no punishment for that, which I just find incredible.
Absolutely. Well, Dan Kennedy, some great information in the course of this conversation with you. I thank you so much for being with us today. And just remind those who are listening of your books and where they can find them.
Okay, well, sure. Thank you so much. My two most recent books are both about the future of news, and they're called The Return of the Moguls and The Wired City. And they can find out about them at my website, which is dankennedy.net.
All right. Well, wonderful job today. Thank you so much for being with us here on America Trends.
Thank you so much, Larry. I really appreciate having the chance to talk with you.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com.